This is Limitless Possibility. I'm Luc-Olivier Dubablet.
And I'm Yannick Magnan.
And what's our topic for this week, Yannick?
It's the long-awaited return of the Tokyo Travel Guide.
Good. We don't have follow-up this week, but I just have a quick note. If you hear my voice and you feel that I sound strange, it is normal. I'm a bit under the weather for this week, so please be patient with my voice. But like Yannick mentioned, let's jump into the main topic.
All right, so last time I did a Tokyo Travel Guide episode was episode 54, all the way back in 2016. I think I was just about to go on another trip. It might have been like my fourth time in Japan at that time or something to that effect. So this episode is coming essentially 11 years after I first went to Japan. I've been to Japan, I think, 7 times. I've lost count. I've been to Japan a lot, mostly in the Tokyo metropolitan area, and one of the things that came up a lot, especially after the first couple times I went to Japan, is that friends would ask me for tips and recommendations for things they should do if they are planning their own Japan trip. And so that's why we did the original episode. And then a couple years ago, I was listening to it, and I realized that half the things in that episode no longer exist, so it isn't really applicable anymore. So I thought we were due for an update in a COVID is still around, but somewhat post-COVID world. What does the Tokyo Travel Guide episode look like? Well, it's going to look like what you're going to get on this episode.
Right. The pandemic did impact a lot of the recommendation location that you mentioned, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, half pandemic, half the death of arcades in general. Certainly accelerated by that. So I'm going to start off by talking about what seasons you should go to Japan in. Just to give you a little bit of an overview, winter is usually somewhere between 1 and 12 degrees Celsius. Spring is 4 to 23 degrees Celsius. Summer is 18 to 31 degrees Celsius. And I would even say that the climate chart on the Tokyo Meteorological Society or whatever website is downplaying a bit. It's closer to like 36 highs in summer, 37 highs recently. Couple that with max humidity, it is easily the worst time of the year to visit. I have gone during summer and I hated it. So, and I love going to Japan, so that's, take it from me.
I would interrupt you here just to make it clear. Yannick is not a summer person, so I would say take that with a grain of salt. In general, like 35 plus is not a great temperature, even here, even for me as a more of a summer person. But yeah, would maybe not downplay too much the summer.
I would say that the people who were with me the one time I went in summer are summer people, and they did not enjoy their time.
Okay, that's a fair caveat then.
Yeah. And then fall is 8 to 27 degrees Celsius, depending on what end of the fall you fall on. But like I went in October, and sometimes I would get days that were like 20 degrees, which was weird for me as a Canadian. Generally, I would recommend that people go in either late winter or autumn. And there's like two reasons for this. Of course, it's like the weather is pretty good. I think late winter opens up the chance of getting early cherry blossoms in certain parts of Japan, which I was lucky enough to have in like late February, early March this year. So that is an option, although you can't count on it, of course. And then in fall, certain parts of Japan just look absolutely stunning with the fall foliage. So like you can't really lose in those two. And of course, the temperature is just much more reasonable. But the other reason I'm mentioning it is typically airlines will discount flights to Japan in late winter or autumn by a few $100s. So those are really the times you can get in with a pretty good deal on airline tickets, which coincidentally is the next thing I'm going to be talking about. So there are two main international airports in the Tokyo metropolitan area. There's Narita Airport, which is 70 kilometers out from central Tokyo. It's in Chiba Prefecture. It's not actually in Tokyo proper. It takes about 40 minutes to an hour to reach Tokyo by train. So you're, despite being called Tokyo International Airport, it is not actually in central Tokyo. The one that is in central Tokyo is Haneda Airport. It is located on the border of Tokyo and Kanagawa Prefecture, which is one of the neighboring prefectures. It is very close to some of the major railway hubs that can take you anywhere throughout Tokyo, but you're pretty much in the heart of the city. And it is generally way more liked by travelers who have used both. However, depending on your starting location, you may only have the illusion of choice between these two airports. So, for example, for me, I can technically choose to go to Haneda, but it would cost twice as much, and it would involve much longer and much more distant connecting flights. And that's not cool. But this varies wildly from region to region. I know some of my friends in Europe can go to Haneda no problem, and it doesn't cost twice as much for them. So for them, it makes perfect sense to go. I'm very envious of people who can realistically fly into Haneda without getting price gouged, but that is not the case here in Canada, so I'm not going to pretend like it's viable.
Isn't it just an Eastern Canada thing? Because of the more or less direct route from Montreal to Narita with Air Canada. Or that would apply to most of Canada.
I'm pretty sure it's the same deal if you're leaving out of Vancouver or any other Canadian airport. I think you don't have a choice but to fly into the U.S. To begin with to fly towards Haneda, which makes it suboptimal. I think like most of the routes I had seen recently were like fly to LAX and then LAX Haneda, which is much longer than just flying straight to Narita and taking the train for 40 minutes. So I can't realistically recommend it unless you live in LA and you can just fly directly over. Like, that seems like a great deal. It seems like airports have streamlined a lot of stuff during the COVID years. I don't know if your experience traveling this year maps on with that, but it feels like there's a lot more automation and there's less long queues for manned stations inside the airport to get through customs or whatnot, and it's much faster to get in and out of airports in general than it was previously.
Oh no, that's not my experience.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, no, we had to deal with lines and things dealt with human and things like that. I guess it's maybe based on the location, but whether it was here in Montreal or in Dominican Republic.
Oh, really? Because I felt Montreal was pretty streamlined as well compared to last time I had been.
Funnily enough, we had our e-tickets and they kind of didn't work. So that was fun dealing with that.
Okay, well, that certainly doesn't help.
Yes.
As usual, I'm going to repeat my tip, which is that plane tickets are expensive, but you can also save a few hundred dollars by leaving in the middle of the week instead of a weekend if you have that kind of flexibility. So typically, I tend to leave on like a Tuesday or a Wednesday just because it's cheaper that way. And you also get the bonus that there's less people in lines in the middle of the week when you show up at like 3 p.m. in Narita versus if you show up 1 in the afternoon on a weekend. It's a lot less busy. Next is something that I did not have in the previous episode, and I'm increasingly realizing I should have had it in the last episode, and that is yellow flags before leaving. Things you definitely need to take note of before getting on your flight, and because you might get into trouble. So the first thing is, if you use any kind of medicine, be very careful. Large swaths of over-the-counter and prescription medicine are outright illegal in Japan. This can be ADHD medicine. This can be Advil. This can be literally anything that you think is perfectly normal here. It's probably not normal in Japan. And this is a consequence of the extremely galaxy brain drug code in Japan, which is there's no such thing as soft drugs or hard drugs. If something is a controlled substance, it is the worst kind of controlled substance because there is only one kind of controlled substance, and that controlled substance is illegal. So yeah, go check the list of controlled substances on the Japanese customs website. For certain types of medicine, generally prescription-based, like, you might be able to get like a special kind of permit that allows you to enter the thing with your medicine, but in limited amounts, and it just seems like a major pain in the ass. Do your research. If you can, I strongly recommend not bringing any medicine with you at all and just buying what you need in Japan to avoid the whole legality gray zone. If you can buy it in Japan and you're buying it from like a drugstore and not a drug dealer, you can probably get away with it.
I thought that was one of the new tips, is finding a drug dealer locally, and then voila, problem solved.
Nope.
I was not expecting that. Wow.
But yeah, I mean, I guess I'm privileged that I don't have any medicine, so it never really came Fair. To my mind. But talking to more neurodivergent friends in the recent years, it's become something I've become more aware of. So I just want to brief people on it because you may be one of those friends listening to this episode.
And kidding aside, though, I think especially if you're really... if things as simple as Advil can be on the prohibited list, I think that goes against a typical tips you generally hear when you travel, which is bring as much stuff that you might need from home so that you, if you're in a hurry or in a, especially in a country you don't speak the language, you don't have to deal or try to find it during an emergency. So having a small like first aid kit that might contain a few off-the-counter pills that might then be illegal is something that could happen to myself personally, because that's usually what we do. We do bring a lot of things just in case. So good to know that they are more strict about that and that we should look.
And as a friend who was scrambling and running around to all the different drugstores trying to get pills for people, for my friends who had headaches one time. yeah, it can be stressful to find that stuff in the moment when you need it, especially mm-hmm. if you don't necessarily know the words in Japanese. But unfortunately, because the drug code is so bananas, you kind of don't really have a good option. The next yellow flag is if you have visible tattoos, you might run into trouble. Again, I am terrified of needles, so that is not a problem I have to deal with. but tattoos have a negative connotation in Japanese culture due to how they are regulated there. Basically, like I may be misspeaking, but my understanding of it is that essentially tattoos can only be administered in Japanese society by actual physicians, doctors, and if you do not have a doctor's license, you can't give tattoos. And therefore, if you see someone with a tattoo, the chances that they got that tattoo from a physician is incredibly low. Therefore, they are signaling to Japanese society that they are someone who does things that are illegal, and therefore they cannot be trusted. So that is kind of what tattoos mean in Japanese culture. And you may be asked to leave certain types of businesses or venues if you have visible tattoos. And it can be the most innocent-looking things. Like, I went to go see the Giant Gundam in Yokohama, which is an outdoor event. It's not, like, an indoor venue at all. But still, I was reading through the rules because I was curious, and they were like, oh yeah, no visible tattoos, by the way. I was like, there's no fucking way they're going to enforce that, but you never know. So I generally recommend to cover them up no matter how small your tattoos are, just to avoid the trouble. And definitely, like, the place you're going to get turned away the most is from hot springs or traditional Japanese inns, unless you can get a room with a private bath, also called a rotenburo. So, like, that's what one of my friends who has tattoos did last time she was in Japan. She just got a rotenburo, and they didn't bother her because she was in her room, so she could do what she wanted. But yeah, that certainly is a thing to consider. If you have like a giant sleeve tattoo, well, sorry. Next up on the list, SIM cards and connectivity.
Ooh.
Yeah, we've got some new info for this one. So obviously not everyone is going to have the most recent phone. So I'm going to list a regular SIM option. And that was what I used before this last trip, which was eConnect Japan. eConnect Japan sells their SIM cards over Amazon.com. They are pretty expensive for what they are. Like if you want to get a 10 gigabyte data plan, it was 6,800 yen for 30 days. That's about $43 US or 60 Canadian dollars at current exchange rates. Although Japanese exchange rate is fucking roller coaster right now. So please convert if you need to. And basically what you can do is you can pre-activate your SIM plan before your flight, swap your SIM card in your phone over the ocean. Remember, before you get on the plane, to disable Find My iPhone. Otherwise, you might not actually be able to turn your phone back on the other side. And you may run into issues if you're an iMessage or FaceTime user who uses your cell phone number as your account, basically. You're probably going to want to tell your friends to call you via email instead, because you're going to be using your new SIM, which has its own phone number, which your friends are probably not going to know.
Oh, and let me tell you, iMessage, even in 2024, still doesn't end all that gracefully.
Yeah.
So even when you come back, expect the first day when you, like, especially when you land and you might not receive iMessage for a few hours, or some might go through and then a friend say, hey, you don't see my replies. And you just need to trust that it will self-heal, and it usually does, but it's kind of worrisome when you first experience it again.
However, in the modern day, there's something even better that exists, and that thing is called eSIM. So if you have a relatively recent unlocked iPhone or Android phone, I believe the first one that it can actually support loading a second SIM as an eSIM was the 10S generation of phones. But basically, an eSIM is a SIM card you can essentially download over the internet instead of having a physical one. And what this allows you to do is to freely be able to flip between your SIM that you want active in the OS at any time. This eliminates all the iMessage and FaceTime binding issues. This eliminates all of the Find My iPhone issues. Well,
not maybe the Find My iPhone, but I can tell you that I did have issues with iMessage because I still disable my primary line.
Okay, well, I don't use iMessage or FaceTime enough for it to show up for
yeah,
me.
Yeah, yeah. So that's why I'm stepping up, because I do use a lot of iMessage, and yeah, it kind of worked, and it was mainly because of the email address thing. But to be honest, Tony had more success rate just over Wi-Fi, because in theory, you just put his phone on airplane mode, so he didn't really change. Disable his locals. His Quebec SIM to use a local SIM. It just keep it on airplane mode and it still worked. Whereas I had a few issues, but still certain messages were coming through, but it was weird for a few hours when I landed.
Okay, I didn't actually try using iMessage or FaceTime. I think I just saw that my number was still listed in my bound accounts for iMessage and FaceTime, and I assumed that it worked. But that is good to know. But yeah, Find My iPhone, no issues there, thank God. That was so annoying before.
Yeah, you got burned so bad with this.
Yeah. You also don't have any stupid APN file to deal with. Sometimes when you're using a regular SIM, you also need to install an APN profile on your phone, which is a little file thing, and sometimes it gets awkward to install that when you're offline or whatever. Like, it's a lot less complex, and if you can use an eSIM, I greatly suggest using an eSIM. The one I used this time was Ubigi, U-B-I-G-I. It was 10 gigabytes for $15, which is an incredibly good rate. So I would recommend that one. I did find the app to be somewhat buggy for configuring a new account, so I think, like, I recommend the service, but I would recommend signing up and paying via the website instead of using the app, and then installing the SIM with the app afterward instead of doing everything in the app. Of course, different options are going to be available to different regions of the world, so these are the ones that worked for me, but if you want to find options that are available in your country or region, I would recommend either the prepaid data SIM card wiki, which I'll have a link for in the show notes, or eSIM database, which is specifically an eSIM resource that will get you other eSIMs to install onto your phone for various countries.
I'm glad to hear that the eSIM option was the cheaper one compared to getting a physical SIM because from my and friends' personal experience in different location, of course, we're not talking about Japan here for this tip, but usually the eSIM providers are quote-unquote worldwide providers, meaning that you can select plans for, like, they don't care where you are coming from, but they just care about your destination, and they offer you different types of plans, so only for that country or that geography, so you could get like full Europe plans, for example. And usually, from what I've seen and from what my friends have experienced, those are a little bit more expensive than some more really local options that would then require to buy a SIM in a store, things like that. So I'm glad to see that the cheaper option for Canadians going to Japan might just be an eSIM, because it's so much easier to deal with than trying to find a SIM card, especially if you have to buy it at destination.
Yeah, or even if you get it shipped, sometimes it gets there like the day before you leave and you're like, oh, I almost had no SIM and that would have been terrible. Yes. So yeah. Just as a side note, I did not mention any of these options, but another very popular option is to rent a pocket Wi-Fi at the airport. Generally, there are like there's another like floor on top of the departures lobby where you can go and basically like rent SIMs or pocket Wi-Fis. I generally have not done that because I've just used my phone directly and I didn't really care that much about it. But if you're traveling as a couple, this can be a good way to save some money. So it is an option. But I try to spend as little time in the airport as possible. So I just try to get the fuck out of there. And speaking of getting the fuck out of there, let's talk about getting out of the airport and wherever you're staying.
Trains. Oh, no. Okay. No, too early, I guess.
Well, yes, it is trains.
Oh, okay. Good, good.
But the options are going to depending on which airport you're coming from. So if you're landing in Narita, one of your options is the Narita Express. This is a JR train. It is a longer train ride than some of the alternatives, but you have more exit options. So your possible exits here are Tokyo, Shinagawa, Shibuya, Shinjuku, Yokohama, and Ofuna. So you can get off at any of those stations from the Narita Express. The one-way ticket is between 3,070 and 4,700 yen, depending on how far you go on the line. And if you're staying for 2 weeks or less, you can save a lot of money, up to 50%, by using the NEX Tokyo Round Trip ticket, which you can buy at select ticket machines or at a JR East travel center. And yeah, basically, if you have your return trip within 14 days, you can save essentially half off, which is a pretty good deal. So I'm recommending it for that reason. It's also just a pretty interesting trip. I really like that train ride a lot. It gives you a really cool vibe as you go towards Yokohama. Well, assuming you're going all the way out, you can also just stop before then. But like I've always said, like Chiba looks like it was preserved snapshot of the 1980s. And then you get to Tokyo and you have the super modern architecture. And then you get to Yokohama and then you see like the 80s idea of what the future would look like. And it's just like this fascinating trip through time on the Narita Express. So I just really like that train. And that is generally what I use. However, because I had some logistical issues on my return trip, I also got to try another option because, surprise, all of the JR trains to go to the airport were suddenly down. So I had to take an alternative. So I took the Keisei Skyliner, and this is a Keisei train that will take you to either Ueno or Nippori for 2,580 yen in 41 minutes. So it's pretty fast. It feels faster than the Narita Express, but that may just be because the route is more urban than the Narita Express is for a lot of it. And Ueno and Nippori are incredibly well-connected stations that can get you pretty much anywhere in Tokyo rather easily. The reason I'm not recommending this one as strongly is that generally, if you're a beginner to getting around Japan, you're probably going to get around more on JR lines than on private railways. And basically, like, you're not going to go to Ueno station, the JR station. You're going to stop in Keisei Ueno, which is a separate station from JR Ueno, and you're going to have to do the connection on foot between those two connections. And if it's your first time, it can be overwhelming. Whereas if you just stay on the Narita Express, you stay within the JR system, and the chance that your transfer is going to be in the same building than where you get off if you actually have to transfer is much, much higher. So like the easy way is to do the Narita Express, and yes, it is more expensive than Keisei, but who cares? And then it's just easier from that point out. There are other options. There's something called the limousine bus. There are slower trains. I'm not particularly familiar with them myself. Also, just as a note, I never check any luggage when I go to Japan, but I do know that some people are fans of luggage delivery companies, which handle airport to hotel luggage transfers. And they do a lot of stuff for you, and it's a lot less trouble than having to lug everything onto a train that has limited luggage space. So you may want to look into those if you're coming into Narita. Haneda Airport, obviously, I have a lot less experience on that side of things, but it essentially connects to two different major options. There's the Tokyo monorail, which connects the Haneda Airport to Hamamatsusho, which can take you to the Keihin Tohoku line, the Yamanote line, the Asakusa line on the Tokyo Metro, the Oedo line on the Tokyo Metro. And if you get off at Tennozu Isle instead, you can also ride the Rinkai line. Probably doesn't mean much right now if you've never been to Japan, but pretty good connections, honestly. There's also the KQ Airport line, which I know nothing about, so I'm not going to talk about it. Then once you've actually gotten to where you're staying, you probably want to get around on the actual trains. And one of the things that I hear the most about is Japan Rail Pass. Japan Rail Pass is offered by JR. It is essentially a pass that lets you ride any JR train that is not a limited express. Actually, no, I think it includes Limited Express. Basically, you can ride anything on the JR network. It's a really good deal, especially if you want to get out of Tokyo. But maybe this is an unpopular take, but I think it's a repeat visitor recommendation and not recommended to first-timers. And the reason for this is Japan Rail Pass is limited to lines on the JR network, which I know this will contradict what I just said about the Narita Express. You're going to need to do some careful planning of your routes to only go through JR lines if you actually want to get the most out of this. And I think it's good to become familiar with the rail system and getting around Tokyo before picking up one of these so you can more easily recognize which lines are JR lines and which lines are not JR lines when you're routing your stuff. It's not that complicated, but it can be overwhelming for people who are just getting used to the notion of this giant transit network. So I'm tempted to say repeat visitors. I would have been overwhelmed if I had had this during my first trip.
I was about to say, you mentioned that some of the railways are private companies, right?
Yes.
So if you're not used, the way I should say it is if you use for in cities that only have one company for transit, per city, or for example, or that there's a one corporation or state-owned company that owns it, having to deal with multiple companies doing transit might also add some complexity that you're not used from what you'd have to deal with at home.
Actually, no, and I'll get into that very shortly.
Interesting.
And there's a very good reason for that. But the main reason I'm recommending against it is that, like, 90% of the time you're going to be using like Google Maps, Apple Maps, whatever maps app you're using. And those apps don't have a way of saying, I only want to have JR trains on my lines.
Oh, okay.
So you're going to look up these directions. And unless you can actually like quickly recognize which symbols are JR and which aren't, you might just screw yourself and try to do something. And then you hit a brick wall because your pass isn't actually valid on the next train line you have to take. And it's just kind of screwing you. So I think like if you're very good about planning out your routes and recognizing which train line is which, Japan Rail Pass is a major savings and it can be a really good deal for people. If you're a first timer, just focus on getting around the place and getting comfortable with that idea instead of becoming obsessive about planning out your train routes, because you won't enjoy your trip if you're obsessively planning out your train routes, unless you're a major train nerd. Like, more power to you if that's you. So let's get into the next thing, which is, of course, Suica and Passmo. Of course, of course, of course.
Mobile payments!
Who do you think we are? So Suica or Passmo, if you're not familiar, or if you're a first-time listener to the show, they are what's called transit IC cards. Transit IC cards are an interoperable contactless payment standard, which is the most widespread card payment technology accepted across Japan. And Suica and Passmo are the two brand names of the two cards that are used within the Tokyo metropolitan area. And they can be used to ride basically any transit across Japan that is not a limited express train, a Shinkansen, which is a bullet train, or a highway bus across Japan. You can also use it to pay in most stores. If you just say Suica to the cashier, they will ring you up a Suica payment and you can just pay using your Suica card or your Apple Watch or your iPhone. A Suica card, whether it's virtual or a physical one, can store up to 20,000 yen. At current exchange rates, this is $129, which is nuts when you think about it, and 178 Canadian dollars. Unfortunately, acquiring one is not as straightforward as it used to be. Since August of 2023, there has been a semiconductor shortage, which has limited the supply of physical Suica or Pasmo cards. Right now, the only Suica cards you can buy in Japan are welcome Suicas, and you can only buy them from airport JR travel centers. So if you miss your shot at the airport, you're kind of screwed. Welcome Suicas only work for a period of 28 days and are only given to people with foreign passports. So like, don't put a ton of money on them, because if it stops working after a month, I don't know what happens to that money. So yeah, oops. The other way to get a smart card, of course, is to use an iPhone or an Apple Watch and use Mobile Suica or Pasmo within the wallet app. However, if you're a listener of the show, you know what's coming. There's a big catch. You can't charge your Mobile Suica or your Pasmo within the wallet app with a foreign Visa credit card for dumb political reasons. Essentially, Visa is mad that Mobile Suica and Pasmo are doing what Visa would like to do better than them, so they decided to shut it down for foreign cards, which means unless you have a MasterCard or an American Express, you can't really charge over wallet, which is a pain in the ass. I got an American Express card just for this reason. Well, that and Aeroplan points. And like, given the scarcity of physical Suica cards right now, this really fucking sucks. And this is like, Visa is such fucking bullshit. Like, this is a major tourism problem that the Japanese government needs to do something about. Like, it's fucking so many people over, and I don't think anyone really realizes how bad it is, except for Visa, which is just laughing. Yeah, it's a giant pain in the ass. But please take that into consideration, because it can screw you. Suica and Pasmo are by far the most convenient ways to use the entirety of transit services across the entire country. And the fact that it is really hard to use for tourists right now is a limiting factor in your enjoyment of Japan. So yeah, just be aware of all of this. Before we get to the next thing, I do want to mention a couple apps to use. So Apple Maps is actually really, really good for transit directions if you're on an iPhone, compared to when it first launched. Right now, it's pretty much the gold standard in terms of transit directions in Japan, which for iPhone users, and it is very up to date with service outages. So I would highly recommend it, especially if you're an English speaker. If you can read or type Japanese, Yahoo Transit is really, really good if you want raw transit routes and not necessarily like door-to-door directions. One of the reasons I really like Yahoo Transit is you can configure your home station and use their widget to get one-tap last train directions, which is great when you're out drinking with buddies, because you know exactly how late you can stay in town or wherever. Also, just good knowledge to have about how the train system works in Japan. The Yamanote Line is a circular loop line in central Tokyo that connects 30 major stations throughout the city. If you're staying in Tokyo proper, learn how to get between where you're staying and the closest Yamanote Line station. Because it is a loop line, even if you mess up which direction you get on, it's just like an easy mode to transit. If you just get on the Yamanote Line, you know that you're going to get to your station within an hour in either direction.
Oh, because it takes an hour to do the loop.
Yes.
Huh.
It's not necessarily the most optimal, and it is going to be incredibly crowded on a rush hour. Like, I can't do anything about that. But it is an incredibly good, easy mode to Japanese transit. So take that into consideration. I also recommend just knowing the names of stations on the Yamanote Line, so that you can more easily recognize if you're within range of the Yamanote Line if you get lost or something. But that's not a huge deal. You can always use your phone for that. Another good thing to know is Tokyo and surrounding areas are all incredibly walkable. You should expect to get a lot more steps on your pedometer or smartwatch than you would back home, to the degree they might actually kill your Apple Watch battery. That's what I learned when I was in Japan last month. Something that you can pretty much gauge is a lot of the time you can easily walk the distance between 3 to 4 train stations. So you don't necessarily need to get on the train and spend money to ride that many train stations. You can probably just walk it within like 30-40 minutes.
But if you're a train nerd, you would like to get in a train and pay for it.
Oh, yeah, like, I'm a sucker like anyone else. I paid for the Minato Mirai line, which is, like, a giant ripoff of a train line, but the train stations are fucking phenomenal, like, architecture-wise, so of course I paid for that, even though I knew it was a ripoff going into it. So, like, yeah.
So, wait, why is it a ripoff? Is it a tourist trap, or there's no another reason?
You can walk the entire line in 30 minutes.
Oh, okay, so it's a big tourist trap.
And it's like, it's very expensive to ride this tiny line that has phenomenal station architecture. So it's like, yeah, there's no real reason to ride it unless you're extremely lazy or you want to see the architecture of the stations.
And you like trains.
Yeah, of course. Next section is going to be about COVID before safety.
Before you go there, because I did have a cute... two questions regarding apps. First one, I was curious to know if you were using Transit app, since I know you do use it a lot locally here.
It does not support Tokyo, as far as I know.
Oh, okay. That answered my question. And I'm not sure if you will cover that in another section, but since we talked about mobile payments, is Tokyo still really cash focus? Or did credit card adoption grew in the past years?
Yeah, so I wasn't intending to talk about this on this episode because it's a bit technical, and I try to keep these less technical because not everyone who listens to this episode cares about this stuff.
No, I think I don't want to go into the technical details, but I think it's more like, should people be prepared to either get some yen before leaving, or like, or should people feel confident that they can pay with their foreign credit card? That's more like the approach.
That's a good point. Yeah. So here's what I will say. The thing that accelerated the growth of credit card acceptance in Japan was not actually anything the credit cards did themselves. It was stupid QR code payment apps, because there were so many of them. I think there were like 12 to 16 of them that now they've built them into ATMs, and everyone updated their ATMs, which now also support credit cards. So they just kind of inherited being able to do credit card payments because they wanted to stop having 16 tablets next to the cash register to deal with all of these stupid QR code apps. So yes, credit card acceptance is much, much higher than it previously was. I think a lot of it came over the COVID period, and less so because of the Olympics and stuff like that.
Right. To not have to deal with cash, more or less.
And just for the nerds who've listened to every episode of this show, and especially episode 2, I'm going to say, like, Suica has less of an advantage nowadays than it used to, because previously there was one contactless payment option, and it was the Transit IC system. So there was a dedicated key on the register that was just Suica, and you said Suica de, and they pressed it, and you were paying, and you were out. Now, there are like 37 different ways to pay at any business, and Suica is in a sub-menu somewhere, and it lost that advantage, which really sucks, because it's still the technically superior option. But yeah, you can use your credit card now in more places. So if you don't want to bother, you can use your credit card in more places. I will say Transit is still more accepted than credit card, but it is a minor advantage. And you're still going to want some cash on you. But like, honestly, nowadays with the wallet app and Suica on my watch, I think I just went to the ATM like twice instead of like 8 times. Which means I use a lot less cash than I used to, which is great for me.
And all of those previously cash payments were using Suica, not your own credit card.
Yeah.
Okay, perfect. That's exactly what I wanted to discuss about, because I think this is important. And yes, it is related to mobile payments, because the culture in Japan is quite different on how you pay for things. I think throughout our history of talking about mobile payments, we also talk about the cash-heavy culture. So I was curious to know if that changed, pre-pandemic versus post-pandemic and or post-Olympics too. But it seems that it's more the QR code. And I think you talked about the different QR code apps. I think we had an episode.
Unfortunately,
about
yes, we did have an episode about that when we did the follow-up on mobile payments, which I'll link to in the show notes.
So if you're curious, I think you should go back to our to this follow-up episode, because this was a funny one. I just remember the craziness of all those QR code apps. And if you want an episode where Yannick is pissed, this is one of them.
Yeah. So we're continuing the trend of just dovetailing right into the next thing I'm going to talk about. Let's talk about COVID safety. So one of the questions I've heard a lot from people is, what is masking like in Tokyo? And with regards to Tokyo residents and workers, I would say that masking in public still feels a little bit higher overall than it was in pre-pandemic times. It's about a 50-50 split in public these days. Tourists will almost never mask anywhere. So if this is something that bothers you, you may wish to avoid areas that are frequented by large groups of foreigners. Akihabara is one of the worst places for this, honestly, because it's almost just tourists now. And we'll talk a little bit about how Akihabara is going later. Masks are easily obtainable at convenience stores or dollar store chains like Daiso. Though you're not going to be finding N95 masks that easily. It's about comparable to finding them here. So I recommend bringing your own if you are one of the N95 lovers in chat. The only time that you're going to be asked to take off your mask at a Japanese airport will be going through customs or boarding. Otherwise, you can pretty much just keep it on the whole time. One thing I didn't necessarily realize before I went back to Japan is how many sort of gray areas exist. There are so many indoor-outdoor transitions as you walk throughout a city that it's actually kind of annoying to take your mask on and off during these transitions, which is why I just pretty much left my mask on everywhere unless I was eating because of this. Next up, I want to talk about the language barrier.
I expect a big section here.
It's not that big. Generally, people ask me, like, how much of the language do you realistically need to know to get by on a trip to Japan? It's always going to depend on where you're going. If you're in the Tokyo or Yokohama area, you can pretty much just get by using English for most things, especially if you're not going out of your way into, like, small restaurants on the side, and you're going into, like, things at eye level, which I will discuss later. You're probably going to be just fine. Like, I was accompanying my friends on a previous trip, and I was translating for them. But, like, some days I just wasn't with them, and they were able to eat and live just fine, right? So it's not the end of the world. Same deal if you head out to Kyoto or Osaka, because they're big tourism cities. You're not going to have some issues there. Anywhere else is a dice roll, though. If you decide to go to Sapporo or whatever, because you know the name from the beer, but it's not necessarily like a big touristic center, good luck getting by with only English. You might be able to navigate the trains fine, but actually getting served in English, like, forget about that. So generally, I would recommend staying around the Tokyo metropolitan area or around big touristic cities. Otherwise, you may be disappointed. Even in Yokohama, like, Yokohama is technically the most cosmopolitan city in all of Japan and the most multicultural. When I ran into my train logistics issues at the tail end of my trip, I found out that nobody at Yokohama Station actually speaks English at the JR service counter. So they were using translation apps, and it was taking literally three times as long for the person who didn't know Japanese than it did for me. So you can still get screwed, but it's just going to take longer. You're not going to be completely shut out.
I like that you mentioned translation app, because, again, I went to a country that speaks Spanish and I don't speak Spanish. And those are amazing. It seems to me that they gained popularity so much in the past 5 years that, and again, it's, let me just do the calculation. Yeah, the last time I traveled in a non-English speaking country was in 2017, before that. So the jump between 2017 to now 2024 was pretty frequent, even if those apps existed at that point. But the fact that you can just speak to them and then it does quote-unquote live translation, like, it's magic. I agree with you. It takes more time than being fluent in the language, but still way much of a time saver than the previous ways of doing that.
This was not necessarily in my notes, but if you're looking for a Japanese dictionary app that you can install on your phone, at least on iPhone, I don't know about the equivalents on Android, Imiwa, Imiwa, is a really good one on iPhone, and there are multiple reasons for this. One of the great features about it is if you have something on your clipboard, when you launch the app, it will automatically analyze it, which means it will pick apart every single word in that sentence and give you a translation of each word. So it's obviously not as rich as a complete translation, but as a language learner, it is incredibly useful to know what matches to what, like what word matches to what meaning necessarily. And it's also just a good way to find other words to add to your flashcards or whatever if you're studying. So that's really useful. The other thing that's really great is search by radical. Basically, anytime you look at a kanji character, a lot of the times there are subcomponents of those characters that repeat in multiple characters. And what search by radical lets you do is it lets you say, just tap all of the shapes that appear in the kanji, and it will build you a list of all of the kanji that has that have those shapes in it. So you can search by the shape of the kanji and not necessarily by how it is pronounced, which is how you normally type it. So that can be useful as well, although it is time consuming if you're not used to kanji radicals and all of that stuff. But it can save you in certain cases. So that's a good one. And I guess like if you're on Android, you can just go use the Jisho website, jisho.org, which is essentially the same data set as an Imiwa, except it's on a website instead of a native app that is available offline. And another cool thing is there is an examples database on both of these apps where you can search for a word and it will give you example sentences on how to use that word. And you can search for the English word as well. So you can basically just get like pre-made example sentences in, of what you want to say in English translated into Japanese. If you want to express something, but you don't necessarily want to use a translation app, you can do things that way as well.
Cool.
Okay, let's talk about some places to go. Something that we briefly touched on in the last travel guide episode was Tokyo DisneySea versus Tokyo Disneyland. And back when I did the previous episode, I had been to neither of them. And since the last travel guide episode, I have been to both of them. So I can offer a bit more information here. Tokyo DisneySea and Disneyland are on the same property. So essentially, if you go left, you have one. If you go right, you have the other. But you enter at the same gates, essentially. And Tokyo DisneySea is more focused around teens and adults wanting to enjoy themselves as a group, whereas Tokyo Disneyland is more of your typical Disney park kid-friendly fare. So the one that is going to be more novel to people who have been to other Disney parks is going to be DisneySea, because it is a different thing, whereas Disneyland is just more so more of what you've seen in other Disney parks. I went to both as an adult, and I think both of them are enjoyable in their own right, even as an adult. Primarily, the point I want to stress here is that you are going to want to plan your days obsessively for this. I am generally a very hands-off, kind of improvise what you're going to do in the moment person. And that really screwed us over when I went to DisneySea. I ended up having more fun at Disneyland because I was there with a Japanese friend who obsessively plans this shit and made sure we had a good time. And so even though we were in the kid park, we had a lot more fun than when we were in the adult park, just because we actually got to go on rides. So
yeah,
that changes a lot of things. Another thing that I think is really stupid, and I hope they fix this since I've last been to Disneyland, is that the Tokyo Disney application was locked to the Japanese App Store. So if you did not have a Japanese App Store account, you could not download the app and you could not do stuff like get virtual fast passes, which is stupid. You're at a massive disadvantage if you don't do that.
Yeah, because that's the only way to get fast passes at Disney anymore now is through the app. Oh, that's dumb.
That's how it was in 2019 when I last went. I don't know if they've changed the availability of the app since then, but I thought it was completely stupid. Wow. So if you have, for some reason, an online Japanese friend who is willing to figure this shit out with you, that is the way I would recommend going to either of these parks. Otherwise, like, you might not realize that there is something you can do because it's not visible to you if you have a foreign App Store account, for example. So do your research and plan obsessively, and you may have a more enjoyable time. But the parks are pretty cool. They're pretty damn cool. It's just, it's less cool when you can't go on the rides.
Yeah, and I think what you experience is the general tip of going to any Disney property is there's a lot of shit to do, so you gotta plan in advance. And again, I haven't done my research on DisneySea nor Disneyland in Tokyo, but I wouldn't be surprised knowing there's a lot of people on the internet that love Disney and their theme park, that there are in English guides that could help you figure it out if you're unlucky and you don't have a local Japanese friend.
Possibly. Also, if you ever find yourself there during New Year's time, that is generally one of the most recommended times to actually go to these Disney parks, because all of the locals in Tokyo are actually visiting their families out in the countryside, which means there's a lot less people at Tokyo Disney than there was the week before at Christmas. So it's generally a pretty good time on New Year's Day to go there, because you essentially have the entire park to yourself as foreign tourists. So yeah, that is something I believe I mentioned on the previous episode, but I want to repeat it here. Next place to go that I'm going to recommend is World Game Circus in Tachikawa. And this is an extremely me pick because it is one of the very few notable music game focused arcades which remain in the Tokyo area. So World Game Circus is not actually one arcade. It's three arcades which are located basically on three different blocks that are adjacent to each other in Tachikawa, which is a really weird neighborhood of Tokyo. Not weird because it's bad, but because you don't really have any reason to go there, because it's not really like a center of anything. It's just a place in Tokyo. But what's special about World Game Circus is that they are an arcade that specializes in old versions of music games. So if you listen to the previous episode, Tri Tower, which eventually became Eternal Amusement Tower, which eventually closed down. They were previously in Akihabara, and they had sort of that niche figured out. WGC basically took over that responsibility, and they essentially have three arcades where they have a rotation of inventory of old versions of Konami music games and not even just Konami music games, just music games in general, including like weird Korean games you've never heard of that just happen to exist. Like, I played a really fucked up game that had like poppin' music buttons, 5-key Beat Mania buttons, and a foot pedal at the same time. And I was like, what the fuck is this game? This makes no sense. And indeed, it made no sense, but it was really funny to try. So yeah, they rotate their inventory of cabinets on a monthly basis. So check their website if you want to see what specific versions they have in specific cabinets. Sometimes you can get some really funny combinations. Like, I played a relatively recent version of Beatmania 2DX on one of the oldest Beatmania 2 cabs that existed. So it was an experience that you would never have naturally. But since they have basically everything, they were able to make it happen. And it was a really interesting experience for me. I was also able to play 2DX Red, which was the arcade version when I started getting interested in Beatmania. So I was finally able to play the arcade version of the game that made me interested in Beatmania in the first place. So that was really fun. So if you're a music game nerd, which a few of you do listen to the show, WGC is highly recommended. It's also a kind of a weird place because they have sort of a self-service model. Essentially, like, the entire arcade has no staff. Like, well, I mean, they have staff, but they're not necessarily present while the arcade is open. So there's just like a sticker with the person's phone number on it, which is like, call us if there's a problem with the cab. Otherwise, like, just plug it in and turn the power on and you can just play.
Wow.
Yeah, it's an extremely Japanese sort of like, yeah, we trust you to do the right thing, which is odd for someone from the West. But it certainly is a fun place to be. I spent my friend's birthday there and we played a bunch of games together, so that was a lot of fun. And I hope to go back some other time and play some other weird old versions of music games that I haven't played before. Next point is Mount Takao. Mount Takao is a large mountain in the heart of Tokyo, not too far from Hachioji Station in the west. And the reason I'm mentioning this is not everyone is necessarily going to want to do the journey out to Mount Fuji. It can be a big step if you're not necessarily used to hiking mountains and stuff like that. Mount Takao is sort of a nice middle ground where it is going to be fun, but it's not going to be incredibly challenging. And I just enjoyed this journey up the mountain way more than I thought I was going to, and it was a highlight of my recent trip. So that's why I'm calling it out. It has 7 different walking paths. It also has cable car access if you're not like me and show up literally 30 seconds too late to get on the thing. The peak is 599 meters of altitude, and the walking paths are about 6 kilometers long, which is pretty good. I just had a great time there. If the weather is good, you can even see Mount Fuji in the distance, so you can get some great photos. You're going to be able to see a bunch of grandmas hiking the trail that you're like, you are way too old to be on this mountain, but no, they're killing it. I don't know. It was just a lot of fun. Go check it out if you're ever in the area. Next up, I want to talk about some museums, starting with the Omiya Railway Museum. This is actually not in Tokyo. It's in Saitama, which is a neighboring prefecture, but it is easily accessible thanks to the Keihin Tohoku line. And the main reason I'm calling it out, first of all, I'm a train nerd. Like, I don't know if you figured it out. We've had an episode about trains where I talked about trains. I like trains. I was actually amazed by the scale of this museum. Every single time I thought, oh, I'm done with the museum, I can go home now, I discovered some other room or some other wing of the building or some other complete building that took another hour to get through. And this happened multiple times. It's kind of amazing how big this place is. Even in pictures, like, it looks big in pictures, and then you're like, oh yeah, but that's only half of the building, and that's only one of the buildings. It's like, it's crazy. So if you're a train nerd, definitely recommend it. Also, the train station at the Omiya Railway Museum has a train simulator in it, so you can play Densha to Go before you actually go in and see all the trains, which is really cool. And last recommendation I'm going to call out is actually someplace I did not have the time to visit this time on this trip, and I am much looking forward to next year when I will hopefully get to visit it this time. That is the Extinct Media Museums. I think I linked you to this, and
yes.
Yeah. So there are actually two museums. There's one in Otemachi, and there's one in Koenji. And it is an interactive museum, which is to say, any device you see in the museum, you can actually play with, which is awesome. So the Otemachi Museum has 8mm film cameras, camcorders, digital cameras, APS film cameras, optical disc cameras, typewriters, computers, PDAs, flip phones, and recordable media. So that is an insane lineup. And then the Koenji one is actually focused around music players mostly. So Walkmans, iPods, portable music players, radios, cassette tapes, early cell phones, and texting phones, which I guess are like BlackBerries or whatever. Interestingly, the Koenji Museum is also a bar. So starting at 7 p.m., you can actually go there and enjoy a 2,500 yen per hour all-you-can-drink plan if that's just what you want to do. You would just want to play with retro tech and drink all night. That sounds great. You can just go do that. I believe the Koenji Museum, though, is only available, is only open one night a month. So you're going to have to be careful when you actually go there. The Otemachi one, I believe, is open all the time. But yeah, that sounds really cool. And I'm really sad I didn't have the time to actually hit those up this year. But that's what happens when you have too many friends to visit. So yeah. Next up, I want to talk a little bit about Akihabara. I think on the last episode, I mentioned that I'm kind of not that into Akihabara, which is surprising because I'm an anime and game nerd, and that's kind of the anime and game neighborhood. In general, I think like Akihabara is incredibly overhyped for a lot of stuff, and especially if you're thinking of going to Akihabara to find great deals on retro games, I just want to warn you that the days you're fantasizing about are long gone. Everybody sort of saw the pictures on the internet in like the mid-2000s and early 2010s of like retro game stores having bins and bins of Saturn games that they were giving away for free because they didn't know what to do with them. They haven't had those in decades. Like, I've seen a bin of Super Nintendo games that they were giving away for free, and the Super Nintendo games were all basically horse racing games that no one wants to buy. So if you're interested in those, well, I haven't even seen one of those in 5 years. So that era of Akihabara is over. and I just want to give you realistic expectations for what you're going to find for game shopping in Akihabara. Sort of the best case scenario is that the prices in Akiba are going to be comparable to eBay or any other place in Japan. And the worst case scenario is that so many tourists go to Akiba for retro games now that everything is going to be immensely marked up. So generally, I do not recommend buying in Akihabara unless you're even just buying retro games in Japan, unless you're buying a ton of stuff that is going to be hard to find from a single eBay seller, or it's going to be hard to get from a Surigaya order when they have their free international shipping promotions. So that's kind of the hack I'm going to give to anyone who's actually interested in buying retro games, is Surigaya is a used stuff store in Japan, mainly like used nerd shit. And they have very frequent free international shipping promotions on their web store. And their web store appears to basically link up to their entire inventory in all Surigaya stores in Japan. So, like, you have no reason to go buy it over there when you can just buy it with free international shipping when you're back home. And the only reason you would sort of be buying stuff in Japan itself is if you're just finding a lot of rare stuff that for some reason you're not finding on eBay from a single seller, and you'd have to pay like $50 plus on shipping. I don't know.
Free international shipping seems like an amazing deal when that happens.
Yeah, it's just you're not necessarily going to find everything you want on Surigaya at the same time.
Fair.
But yeah, like it's really hard to see what's happening with retro games because you see lots of foreigners going to Japan and buying out entire stores of retro games. They're like, this is clearly a problem because there are like no retro games left for the people who are locals, which is kind of an issue. So like there is a deforestation angle to this that I'm trying to take. At the same time, like my bag was full of retro games, so I'm part of the problem, of course.
I was about to mention this, that I thought you bought a lot of games back, so.
Yeah. So it's a difficult thing to navigate, and like, of course, the weird thing is, once a retro game is bought from Japan and brought back to the West, it's very rare that that game is going to find itself back in the Japanese ecosystem eventually. And that's sort of the weird thing, is like, we're slowly draining the Japanese market of the copies of the Japanese retro games. And there are people like me who are like, if I'm going to sell a used copy of these games back to someone, I'm going to do it when I'm in Japan, and I'm going to put it back into the Japanese market because I don't want to completely drain the market of those copies, you know? But that's a whole other episode.
That's a whole other episode, because we can talk about cameras the same way, right?
Exactly.
All those Japanese eBay sellers, like, draining the used market. But a lot of people buy great cameras from Japan.
Yep. Okay, I want to give some final tips before we go. First thing, you should probably install an application on your phone for earthquake and tsunami warnings. I recommend the NERV app. It is completely bilingual. Please note that the Japanese earthquake scale is different from the Richter scale that you're going to be seeing everywhere else in the world. I don't know why they do this way, but that's Japan, baby. I generally recommend that if you have this app installed, you enable alerts for earthquakes 3 or more on the Japanese scale. Generally, this will map to anything you can pretty much feel that feels like a big deal if you're not used to having earthquakes all the time. So if you feel something shaking, you will also hear your phone shake, and it will tell you why you are shaking. Sometimes a couple seconds ahead of time, which is really useful to not freak out. Generally, you don't really need to worry about anything below 5, let's say. My next tip, embrace verticality. So this is what I was talking about earlier on. Western tourists in Japan have this problem where they only register businesses that are visible or advertised at eye level, and they pretend like anything else does not exist. And you should be using this to your advantage when you're in areas with high tourist density. For example, you might be able to see a Starbucks with a line out the door, but if you just look up 2.5 meters, there might be literally another coffee shop right on top of it with much less foot traffic. And you could just go up a set of stairs and go to the other coffee shop instead of going to that Starbucks. And this is not a statement about Starbucks. This is just if you want coffee, there's literally coffee there waiting for you if you just go up the stairs. But everyone is too stupid to notice it, so maybe you should notice it.
Oh, I guess, though, it's a cultural thing, right? We're more used here, and I don't want to say too much in Europe, but like, I'll just take a North American stance here. But like, if you look at a typical street which has commerce restaurant, they usually on the first floor, because on upper floors, it's living areas. Like, it's apartments, it's condos, it's things like that. Like, it's rare that we'll see here places, especially on like Commerce Street, that there are multiple floors of commerce on those streets. I guess a good example of that to me here that make me think of that is literally the Chinatown here in Montreal. Like, they have restaurants on top of restaurants on top of restaurants. That's usually where I would go up a flare of upstairs to go to a restaurant, because if I go to others' commercial streets, let's put it this way, everything's on the ground floor.
You can't have that mentality in Tokyo, otherwise you are going to be missing out on most of the city.
Oh yeah. No, I'm not surprised that you do see the common tourists do that, so it's a good tip. I'm just like, I'm not surprised that a lot of people don't know about this.
This is actually something that I had noted down in 2019, because I was literally seeing that Starbucks thing. I was like, did they just not look up 2.5 meters? There's literally another coffee shop right on top. And it's like a chain coffee shop. You're going to get essentially like the same kind of generic coffee there. It's not.
Oh, but now you're opening the can of worms of Starbucks coffee. So I think you should close
well,
that.
Okay. I'm just going to say, like, yes, I understand. Starbucks and like any kind of like McDonald's, anything like that. Like, there is comfort in having predictable products that you can go to. But like, sometimes it's even just like two different Starbucks. Like, there's the one at eye level, and then there's one in the basement, and the one in the basement is empty, and you're like, dude. Like, that, it's not fucking hard.
Yeah, that's where I thought you were going with that explanation. Is like, see, 3 meters away from you upstairs, there's another Starbucks that is empty.
Yeah. Another kind of recommendation along those lines is big department stores. Like you were saying, like, over here, like, a big department store is like what, like 3 floors? In Japan, mm-hmm. like, the big department store is going to be like 14 floors. Oh, so it's not rare to see like one of those big department stores, like there's a secret food court on the top floor and on the bottom floor. And sometimes those secret food courts are a good way to just get lunch without spending all your time waiting in line, because people don't necessarily want to go up to the 14th floor to go buy lunch. Maybe they're just lazy and they want to stay at eye level. So like, sometimes that's what I did in Akihabara one time. I was like, there's a food court on like the 10th floor of the Yodobashi Camera. Let's just go there and see if there's anyone eating there. And it was basically empty. And I was like, cool, I don't have to wait to eat lunch. Definitely just embrace verticality. It is something not enough people do. And you really need to look up and see if there are any other interesting businesses, because sometimes like, there are things you could have only dreamed of that you would have never seen if it was there. It's not just like a replacement coffee shop that's on top. Sometimes it's just like your favorite shop of all time. Next tip is based on a mistake I made this trip. So please don't repeat it. The further you get away from Tokyo, the more your trips will require careful planning. And this is more to talk about trains. So in Tokyo proper, you don't really have to worry about trains. You're going to have trains every 3 to 4 minutes. You don't really have to sweat it. They show up on time. Also, like, that's not really an issue. So extremely predictable, not an issue. Neighboring prefectures like Saitama, Chiba, Kanagawa, all of those places, still pretty common to see trains every 6 to 8 minutes. Not really a thing. However, if you go like 2 prefectures out in any direction, it quickly falls off to like 1 train or bus per hour. And that was something I did not predict for.
Oops.
So I wound up in like a countryside town with like 1 train per hour. And I was like, fuck, I did not plan for this. I did not think that this town was going to be so car-focused that I was not going to be able to walk to the place that I wanted to go. And I basically just went out to the country for 2 hours, realized there was nothing to do there that I could do on foot, and then went back home. And I mean, it was funny. It's a funny story, and I enjoyed my time in the countryside because I rarely get to go out there. But it was still kind of a waste of time, and I could have done a better job of planning my shit out. So please don't repeat my mistake. And last tip I want to do is sort of everyday items that we don't really think twice about, but are surprisingly weird to find in Japan. So the first thing is good deodorant. Look, I don't fucking know, okay? But it's hard to find in Japan. I don't know why. If you're looking for good deodorant, go to the electronics store. Now you're going to say, why the fuck would I go to the electronics store? Why do they sell deodorant? I don't fucking know, but they have an everyday items section. And that's like the only place I was able to find deodorant that actually worked while I was in Japan this time. So this is more a reminder for myself. When all of the convenience stores and all of the drugstores don't have deodorant, go to the fucking electronics stores. I don't know what to tell you. Kind of in the same vein, if you're looking for sanitary napkins or tampons, surprise, Japan has a culture of shame around menstruation, so these are behind-the-counter purchases at drugstores. Good luck!
Oh, boy. Really behind-the-counter. Oh, boy.
Yep.
Fun.
Fun, fun, fun. We love it. But yeah, that pretty much concludes my list of tips for this updated travel guide. I'm sure I will come up with more ideas over the next few days and weeks and months and years, which means we will probably have another one of these in a couple of years as well, and expect follow-up, of course, in future episodes. But for now, this is the snapshot that I'm going to be living with. So I hope you enjoyed it, and I hope you learned something useful that you can put into effect next time you're planning a trip to Japan.
Good. Thank you, Yannick. And as he has mentioned throughout the episodes, you will find a lot of links to these tips and places he has mentioned in the show notes. And you may ask where you find the show notes at limitlesspossibility.net/226 for episode 226. Oh boy, that was hard. You can find our back catalog of episodes at limitlesspossibility.net. The show is on Fediverse. We are at limipo_podcast@mastodon.social. You can also find there individually too. I am at luco@mastodon.social, and you can find Yannick at
Sakarina@icosahedron.website.
We'll see you in 2 weeks.
See you in 2 weeks.